Rick Stevens, financial advisor with FRS Financial Group, offers securities and investment advisory services through Waddell & Reed Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA and SIPC, and a federally registered investment advisor. FRS Financial Group is a separate entity from Waddell & Reed. Insurance products are offered through insurance companies with which Waddell & Reed has sales arrangements. The information presented on this show is solely for information purposes and is not to be construed as an offer to sell or the solicitation of an offer to buy any financial product or service mentioned. Waddell & Reed does not offer tax or legal advice. Please consult with a professional prior to making any financial decisions. Any opinions expressed are those of Rick Stevens and may not be the opinions of Waddell & Reed. The information is subject to change based on market and other conditions. For more detailed information regarding any of the topics discussed on today's show, please call 719-500-8700. This is Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial. Here's your host, Rick Stevens.
Welcome in, ladies and gentlemen, to this edition of Money Matters, presented by FRS Financial Group. I am your host, Rick Stevens, and this is your show. If you've got questions, if you've got things you would love to have answered, feel free to give us a call, 719-500-8700. You can also hit us up on that website, frsfinancialgroup.com. Go to that contact tab in the top right corner, click on that, send us a question, send us a message. We would love to hear from you. Well, folks, this week with us in studio is Evan Withrow, an attorney with Steiners and DeHaas and all the other names that follow along with that. Not to give the other fellas the cold shoulder on there, but it's really Steiners and DeHaas, isn't it, Evan?
Yeah, that's right. We've got a couple other folks on there, but Steiners and DeHaas is enough of a mouthful as it is.
So do you have, because I know you're in the legal world, do you have your own disclaimer that you get to throw out here for us?
I don't know if it's a disclaimer other than this. The information I'll be giving today is strictly general information. If you have specific legal questions, every situation is a little different, so I would need to speak with you about your particular facts and circumstances to be able to provide actually any concrete legal advice. So please don't take today's information as legal advice, because it is not. It is strictly for general information purposes.
And terms and conditions apply, right?
Terms and conditions always apply, Rick.
Awesome. Well, folks, we're talking with Evan today. We're talking about a number of those different things, really as they pertain to both the legacy side of things, but as well as some other really family type matters through here. So Evan, one of the things I want to start out with is this question that you see it on television or in the movies, and quite frankly, it does happen at times in life. And that's this concept of the deathbed will, right? When somebody is, you know, days or minutes from passing away, and all of a sudden they sign off on this new will that you know, leaves everything to one person or another. How legitimate is a deathbed will typically?
As always, the answer is it depends. The classic legal answer. But predominantly, there's nothing about a deathbed will or a will that's signed or drafted shortly before someone passes away that automatically makes it invalid or not enforceable. It's the circumstances around each particular deathbed will, if that's what we want to call it, that can raise questions about the validity, about whether it's legally enforceable. Specifically, where we tend to see challenges most often with regards to deathbed wills, or if that will makes substantial changes to any prior wills or testamentary documents. For example, if you've got three kids and your previous will prior to this deathbed will splits everything equally, and then suddenly this deathbed will disinherits one or two of the kids and leaves everything to one of them, that raises some automatic questions and concerns. The other is that those deathbed wills have to follow the same types of formal execution requirements for wills, which in Colorado is either witnessed by two individuals or notarized in front of a notary public when the signature is signed. The only other alternative to valid execution, if you don't have the two witnesses or a notary, is if you draft what we call a holographic will. And that's something that is all in the testator or the deceased individual's handwriting. So those deathbed wills have to follow all those same execution requirements. I'll tell you that I personally have handled cases where we have challenged wills that were signed day of death or just shortly before because of those types of major changes in distribution of assets. What we also see sometimes is people that don't have anything in place, but they may have multiple kids, and then suddenly one of their kids becomes the main beneficiary, and that raises some questions. But you also have to look at the circumstances of who was around when the will was signed, who's been taking care of mom or dad up until the end of their life.
Right.
Sometimes it is just bad timing. I've had those cases as well where we have everything, it's valid, and it's executed legally and properly. There are no questions as to the capacity of the individual when they signed, or any kind of undue influence concerns that one of the kids was saying, hey, give everything to me. But it just so happened that they signed a day or two before, but it still automatically kind of raises those hairs on the back of your neck, and you get that spidey sense a little bit.
Right, right. Now that's not to say that you shouldn't have any sort of will or testamentary documents in place, right?
Correct. I mean, you want to have something in place, and you can stop me if I misunderstood your question, Rick, but my recommendation always is have a will or a trust or some sort of valid testamentary document in place, and sometimes that means doing things near end of life. My law partner, John Steiner, always says, we have one deadline, we just don't know when that is.
yes, it's true.
And these aren't fun conversations. People don't want to talk about end of life, morality, but the estate planning is for your family as much as it is for yourself. And some people don't get to it until they near the end, whether that's because of a more recent medical diagnosis or just a feeling. So, you know, if you haven't planned, it's not to say don't do anything close to your death. Something tends to be better than nothing most of the time.
Yeah, and the state, if we have nothing in place, if I don't have a will, if I don't have a trust, if I don't have any of that documentation in place, the state of Colorado has one in place for me, right?
That's correct. So in Colorado, if you don't have a will, your belongings, your assets, your estate passes via statute, via Colorado law. And when you pass without a will, it's called dying intestate. So everything follows the intestate statute, which typically means it's going to go to family members. But where you run into issues sometimes is if you have kids that have predeceased and you wanted things to go to grandkids or you wanted the other kids to have it. If you don't have any kids, then it has to kind of search further into the family tree. And then it also raises questions of who's going to be the executor or the personal representative of your estate, which can sometimes cause conflict as well.
And if I remember correctly, in looking at the different ways that the state of Colorado basically goes to search, quote unquote, search for the heirs, they always finish with, and if we can't find anybody, we get to keep it.
That is also correct. Yes. Yeah. So if you can't track somebody down or someone dies without any specific family members that would otherwise inherit under the law, it does, the legal term is called escheating to the estate. Mm-hmm. So it basically reverts back to the state of Colorado. So especially some people think, well, I don't have any kids or I don't have any family, so who am I going to give it to? Well, either you can pick or the state will pick. And by the state picking, I mean they'll take it.
Right, right, right. I have yet to see an opportunity of somebody on the political side, if they had the opportunity to keep the money or send it elsewhere, I think I'd bet dollars to donuts they're probably going to try to keep it in that world. Well, folks, we are up against that first break in the show today. When we come back, we are going to continue talking about this world of estate planning, taking care of some of those important legal documents. Well, quite frankly, before it's too late. So, folks, stick around. You will absolutely want to hear where we're headed next. So what's on your mind these days? Is it your retirement? Maybe it's paying for college. Maybe you've got a life insurance or a long-term care insurance question. Folks, this is Rick Stevens with FRS Financial Group, and we're here to answer those questions that you have. We'll walk with you all steps along the way, figuring out what is in your best interest, what is your goal, and what are the tools we need to get you there. FRS Financial Group, where we put your needs first. Give us a call at 719-500-8700. Well, folks, thanks for sticking around with us here on Money Matters presented by FRS Financial. We are talking today in studio with Evan Withrow. We're talking all kinds of things in terms of estate planning. And Evan, I want to talk a little bit today here in this segment about some of those, I guess I'll call them the other documents that we would typically put together when we're talking about legacy and estate. But these are the different, I guess, powers, if you will, the documents in there, the powers of attorney that we typically hear about. But oftentimes we just hear that one big term, powers of attorney. What kind of different powers of attorney are there, and what ones do we really need to be thinking about?
In terms of powers of attorney, you can have one overarching power of attorney for everything. Typically, what we recommend and what we do in our estate planning process, and that's why we call it estate planning, Rick, you alluded to it. It's not just a will and a trust, but estate planning is that overall discussion of your assets, where they're going to go, but also what happens while you're still alive.
Right,
And that's where those powers of attorney come in. And in my opinion, a lot of the times are as much, if not more important than a will, because powers of attorney can kind of take two forms. They can be a immediate power of attorney that says, when I sign this document, I'm going to turn over decision-making authority to a third party. It doesn't mean it removes your authority, but it means this third party or your agent under your power of attorney can then go and make decisions on your behalf for various matters, which we'll talk about here shortly. Or you can have what we call a springing power of attorney, which is the most common. A springing power of attorney doesn't go into effect unless and until the person signing the document is incapacitated or disabled and can't make decisions on their own. That's why it's important, because if something happens to you prior to your passing, whether it's an accident or progression of a medical condition, you want to make sure you've got somebody that's looking out for your best interests. Because otherwise, if not, all of those things that you wanted to go to your family members in your will could go to places you don't want them to, if you don't entrust it to somebody that will make the right decisions. So in terms of the specific powers of attorney, typically we split it into two categories. One is a medical power of attorney, so someone that can make any and all decisions related to your medical care, your treatment, including medications, things of that nature. The other main category is anything non-medical, what we call a general power of attorney. Most people think of that as a financial power of attorney because it deals with your property, whether it's your home, your bank accounts, your investment, things of that nature.
Awesome. Now, oftentimes I think when we're thinking about those pieces, right, the financial side, the medical side on the powers of attorney, we typically think of folks, you know, as we're aging, right, in our 50s, 60s, 70s, and so on. I've got two adult kids. In the fall, I will have two adult kids in college. One will be 20, one is 18. Because they're adults, is there a need for them to have a power of attorney because they're, you know, they're non-married, they don't have anybody on the, you know, if you look on the hierarchy, they have nobody to the side horizontally, and vertically they have nobody under in terms of the children. Should they have a power of attorney since they're, you know, going to be, you know, 1,000 miles one direction and 3,500 the other?
Well, Rick, it's a good thing this is being recorded because it's one of the few times you'll get an unequivocal answer out of a lawyer. And the answer to your question of should these adult children that are unmarried, they're maybe at college, should they have a power of attorney in place? The answer is yes, yes, and yes. and that's because a lot of people tend to think, well, I'm their parent. If something happens, I can make decisions about their medical care. That's true to an extent, but it all comes down to how much a third party is going to allow you to have authority over that person. For example, with an adult child in college, if they have a bank account in their own name, I can bet you, not quite unequivocally, but 90%+ of the time, the bank will not allow you to access those accounts or that money without a power of attorney in place. And that's because they are adult children, but they're adults, right? They have their own accounts. So it's the same as if any other third party came and said, hey, I want to access this account. They're going to say, show me the authority to do that. Well, I'm their parent. Well, that's not good enough. that's what we tend to run into. And that's why it's really important for adult kids, especially if they're unmarried, to have a parent or some other family member that can make decisions on their behalf if something happens to them.
Yeah, and that kind of came up in my mind when we were taking my oldest to school last fall. And in that parent orientation, they said, guess what? Your child is an adult now. We can't tell you what their grades are.
That's right. Yeah, I think as parents, and I've got the younger kids, but once they turn 18, they have a lot more freedoms and a lot more protections in terms of what parents can access. And just the last little nugget there is if you don't have something like that in place and something does happen to them, the only way to get that authority is to go through a guardianship or conservatorship action through the court, which is going to be a lot more time consuming, a lot more costly, whereas a power of attorney is easy peasy to get done.
Nice. Now, kind of looking at that side of life, right? I know there are other documents we can put together, like a DNR, the do not resuscitate, the medical directives. Because we see it on TV all the time, right? Well, they wanted this, but no, the family decided that. How set in stone, I guess, are things like the medical directives and the DNR orders?
So they can be, and we'll talk in terms of the DNR, the do not resuscitate, is not something that an attorney helps draft. So a do not resuscitate is something that's typically done with your primary care provider or a doctor. That's going to be a matter of, do you want to perform life-saving measures, you know, if you get in an accident or your end of life? That's something that you'll have to talk to a medical provider about. Whereas a medical directive, or what some people call an advanced directive, or what we call a living will, is sort of your end of life instructions to the doctors. So that may sound similar, but largely the living will or the medical directive deals specifically with if you are in a state in which the only thing keeping you alive is artificial nourishment, such as life support, or if you have a terminal disease and the only way you're continuing to exist is through pain-relieving medications or those types of life support components, do you want those to be removed? And that can take the form of either a legally controlling document that says, these are my wishes, this is what the medical staff has to follow, or it can be what we call a preferences document that allows your power of attorney to override the preferences in that living will. That's a decision that you make for yourself and think about with your family in terms of, do you want to make that decision for them, or do you want to allow them, based on the situation at the time, to maybe divert from your preferences?
Thank you. It's a big thing, right? Because we do see it all the time. There are big news stories about, well, they said they wanted this, but we're actually doing that. So good to have that information there. We are up against that final break in the show today. When we come back, we're actually going to get into sort of that transference of assets side of things, how you want stuff to go, where you want it to go, and ultimately getting those wishes out there before that will gets read. And we'll talk about some of that importance in there as well. So stick around. You do not want to mince how we're going to finish up this week. Stick around, everybody. So what's on your mind these days? Is it your retirement? Maybe it's paying for college. Maybe you've got a life insurance or a long-term care insurance question. Folks, this is Rick Stevens with FRS Financial Group, and we're here to answer those questions that you have. We'll walk with you all steps along the way, figuring out what is in your best interest, what is your goal, and what are the tools we need to get you there. FRS Financial Group, where we put your needs first. Give us a call at 719-500-8700. All right, folks, thank you for sticking around with us through that break. I am Rick Stevens. This is Money Matters presented by FRS Financial Group. We're talking today in studio with Evan Withrow at Steiners and DeHaas. We're talking all sorts of things as it relates to your estate planning. And Evan, I tell this story often, but I like to tell my clients that when it comes to dispersing your assets, the only time the whole family should be gathered around the table in the attorney's office for the reading of the will to find out what mom or dad left is in the movies, right? It's best for us to tell our heirs what our intentions are beforehand, right?
Yes, that's definitely a movie and TV show trope. And I have that question a lot because I also handle a lot of probate estate administration on the back end. But the reading of the will is not really a real life thing. Maybe unsurprisingly, given the dramatization you get through TVs and movies.
So one of those questions that comes up, and I see folks that do this often, is transferring what you would call the estate assets prior to their passing away, right? We're going to make sure that this child, this grandchild, this cousin, this whatever, gets this specific thing from the estate. Is that something that's actually easy to do?
Well, it depends.
I love the answer. Perfect.
It depends on the asset itself and what you're looking to transfer. And there's a few other factors you have to think about in terms of transferring those assets, including potential tax implications on what you're transferring and how you're going about those transfers. But that is part of the estate planning conversation. You look at, what do I own? And when we say the estate, some people are like, what's the estate? The estate is all of your assets. It's everything you own. If you draw a big circle around everything you own, your house, your bank accounts, your investment accounts, retirement, life insurance, cars, personal property. And so we will pretty regularly discuss with folks about the potential for transferring some assets prior to their passing. A lot of the times it starts with the small stuff like your personal property, your family heirlooms. Right. And that's because I can't tell you how many times I've seen a probate case that has had conflict solely because someone is fighting over, you know, mom's necklace or dad's tool collection. So those are always good things to kind of look at. But some of the bigger assets, the most common I get, Rick, as an example, is should I put my child on title to my home?
Mm-hmm.
Because I just want it to go to them automatically as a joint owner when I pass away. Most of the time, the answer is no. And that's for a couple of reasons. One is because then they become a joint owner in the home and they can convey their interest in that home if they want to, which means you could find yourself, and not saying that there's this much family dysfunction, you know, but you could find yourself owning a home with some unknown person because your son or daughter decided, well, I need to make some money and I'm going to sell my share in the home. The other issue is it's going to cause potential gift tax issue, right? When you transfer that share in the home without any sort of compensation back to you, it's going to be considered a gift by the IRS. And given real estate values in Colorado and Colorado Springs, it's going to be a big time gift tax.
Yes, yes.
So those are the types of things. Same with joint bank accounts. I get that a lot. Well, I put my son or daughter on the bank account. Well, as long as you trust them implicitly, I suppose that's okay. But again, they have full access to that money. There are some potential tax implications there. But the other thing a lot of people don't think about is it opens up potential liabilities to those assets from creditor to their creditors.
Right.
So if your son or daughter or whoever it is that you're joint with has, you know, a judgment against them, and it could be some freak thing, right? They get in a car accident. Suddenly your home is potentially a gettable asset for those folks. So there's a lot of things that go into it, but you can make transfers, you can gift. It all just depends on each person's circumstance.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Good to know those pieces in there. And yeah, that's I had a conversation not too long ago with clients who, you know, dad wanted daughter on this particular investment account. And but they wanted, after dad passed, the account to go to the estate as a whole. And I said, well, you can't exactly do that if you're joint custody of the account, because there's a portion of it that's got to go to the other, you know, depending on how it's set up, joint tenant, tenant in common sort of stuff. And there's some issues with being able to do it that way. So good to know those pieces out there. You know, one of the things that I have read in the last few months also has to deal with the transfer of digital assets. We've got more of those that we see every day out there. Is there really a difference between transferring digital assets, like any of the cryptocurrency type stuff, versus transferring a car or a house? Is there really any difference in doing those things? Do we need something special for the digital assets?
Not really, Rick, to be honest. So the evaluation there in terms of what those digital assets are comes down to the nature of the assets, in the sense that if you've got Bitcoin or cryptocurrency, it has some dollar value associated with it, whatever that may be. So if your will says, I give everything to my kids equally, then it's just kind of like any other bank or investment account, right? They take the dollar value of those digital assets. where things that don't necessarily transfer, where you have sort of a license, mm-hmm. Like social networking, those types of things, right? That's specific to an individual. Sometimes we see it with like digital music or digital media as well. A lot of the times you're paying for a license when you've downloaded that music.
That nobody reads, by the way.
That's right. Nobody reads the terms and conditions or those sheets that you have to check to purchase things. But that's part of that evaluation. But to get back more to your question, Rick, those digital assets or currency that have a dollar value associated with them will transfer just like anything else you own. However, I will say that if you want specific accounts or specific dollar amounts from those accounts to transfer specifically to a person, I would recommend that you mention it in your will. And that's because a will, more often than not, we recommend to be fairly general. You split according to percentages. But there are a couple things that can't be devised separate from the will. For instance, you can say where your little knickknacks and your personal property goes in a separate piece of paper, but things that you can't put on that separate piece of paper are cash dollar gifts and real estate. So if you say, hey, I've got a Bitcoin account and my one son or my one daughter has really helped me grow that, I want them to have it, that should be in the will. Because if it's written elsewhere, because it's a dollar amount that you're trying to give them, that's something that likely would still fall into the overall estate and could be split equally among all your beneficiaries.
Excellent. Excellent. Great information there. Evan, if folks want to get in touch, if they say, hey, I need to do my estate plan and we need to take care of powers of attorney, how do they get to you?
Yeah, so my contact information, the firm again is Steiner & Zendejas, and the phone number is 719-635-4200. Again, that's 719-635-4200. Just give the firm a call, ask for Evan Withrow, and they'll put you in touch or get you on my calendar, and we can talk more about your situation.
Awesome. Evan, thank you for joining us today. Folks, if you've got questions that you would love to have answered and you've already forgotten what Evan said was his phone number, feel free to give us a call, 719-500-8700. We can get you in touch with the folks over at Steiner & Zendejas as well. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for tuning in this week. We'll be back next week continuing to talk about your money, because your money matters. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.